Hey, everybody, it's Kai. This is the Corner Office Podcast. You might have noticed we came out a day later than usual this week. That is actually on purpose. We are moving this feed to every other Wednesday. You can still get a Marketplace Podcast fix on Tuesday, though. My new one, Molly Wood and me, it's called Make Me Smart. We're diving deep on the news of the day because here's our tagline. You ready? None of us is as smart as all of us. But I know you are here for an interview with the CEO, so let's get to it. This time it is Peter Kim. He's the founder and CEO of Hudson Jeans. It's a high-end premium denim company based right here in Los Angeles. And as you're about to hear, it is a story of a family business.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
Peter Kim, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
You grew up in the garment business.
Yes.
Tell me the story.
So I'm born and raised in L.A.
Yeah.
And if I take it back a little bit, my family's got somewhat of an interesting story, I think. Both my parents are from North Korea. North Korea. So, you know, my mom is born in 42 and my dad in 40.
Wow,
so as conflict and, you know, war starts building in the North South or in Korea at that point, they became refugees into the South.
Yeah.
So they, you know, fled and took off. And so they grew up incredibly poor in the South. And in the early 60s, they ended up immigrating out to the U.S. American dream and so forth. So came to L.A. They did whatever they could to, you know, stay alive, parking cars, busing tables, maintenance, all sorts of stuff.
Save their money. You need to write a book, man. And maybe your parents need to write a book.
So they saved their money. They started an apparel company, Missy Moderate Career Missy Moderate Polyester Blouses, to be super specific. And
there are people in fashion who will know exactly what that means, right? Yeah.
And it was an interesting business, but and it's very niche, but they had an incredible run at it because, you know, you have the 80s come around, working women, dual income, respected.
And then they got into some trouble, right? And that's where you come in.
They made a ton of money, invested all in the real estate. And then the 90s come around and, you know, and their investment, I always kid around, it's not really funny, but if they were able to maintain all the property and real estate that they had, I probably wouldn't be doing
you wouldn't have to be
I'd probably be on a bicycle with a little bell ringing it saying ding ding, put the money in the backpack, you know, because they had tons of real estate all over Koreatown, Mid Wilshire, downtown LA, tons of industrial property in New York, apartment buildings in Beverly Hills, apartment buildings, Palm Springs, Hawaii, a couple of condos and so forth. But, you know, it was the 80s, 90s where they're very low down, you know, highly leveraged because the properties were appreciating so fast. So they're like, why put anything down as small as possible? So that was the real estate piece. And at the same time, the workwear environment changed, right? It went from suits and so forth to it turned into casual Fridays, dress down Fridays, dress down every days. And so their product and their business became irrelevant. You know, there was, you know, dress on Fridays, basically 20% of the work week is gone. And then with dress on every day. So that was an interesting shift. And at the same time, there's so many things going on all at once. They had it was a predominantly Korean workforce. So I mean, Korean, like not English as a second language workforce. With that, the final thing was they had guaranteed a family member's Kawasaki Motorsport dealership. They go bankrupt. They dumped the whole thing on my parents because they personally guaranteed it.
So you're in business school at USC, and one day the phone rings.
It's spring break. Yeah, it's my dad's spring break. I'm sleeping in. He's like, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "I'm sleeping." And he's like, "It's like I think it was like 8 or 9 o'clock." He goes, "You know, it's late." I go, "It's spring break. I'm on break." And he's like, "You need to get dressed down here like now and help out." I'm like, Dad, come on." And so I got thrown into the mix real fast. So worked out my spring break. And then when school started again, I'd go to school in the mornings, go back to the office in the afternoons.
Did you know what you were doing?
No. Yeah. I had no idea. I mean, you know, I always say me and my brother were 3 years apart. He's 3 years younger than me, but we have a really weird but also maybe typical bit of a life. I mean, I always say I could have been the poster child of being a millennial or the stereotypes of being a millennial.
Yeah.
I mean,
you know, which you're not. You're a little old for millennial. Right?
yeah.
Just to be clear.
So, but, you know, just the whole, this we grew up incredibly privileged. You know, mm-hmm. my parents did incredibly well through the 80s, 70s, 80s. And, you know, we didn't have much worries in life as far as financial. Having said that, we were latchkey kids, basically. You know, my parents,
yeah, because your parents
always,
were at the office
always working,
all the time.
Traveling and so forth. And then, you know, we had a lot of internal domestic issues yeah. with family and
family
so forth.
Family stuff, right?
So that created a lot of self-issues with
so
ourselves.
So what's it like to be thrown into a family business that's in crisis and your parents saying, listen, you have to help lead us out of here?
It was, I mean, honestly, when I first got into it, I was a wreck because I had a lot of self-confidence issues. I was super shy. I had a lot of inadequacy. Like, I was just not a stable person, if you can say. Uh-huh. Like, I didn't do well in school. I'm pretty sure I'm dyslexic. I'm pretty sure I have a high level of ADHD. I have OCD issues. So I didn't do well in school, didn't really fit into any of these buckets of success. You know, parents are super hard. You have the whole Asian stereotype
thing,
of
yeah.
study hard, go to, you know, Ivy League schools, become some kind of professional. And
you had all that.
And, yeah. But, I mean, I graduate. I say based on standardized tests, I don't speak English, and I'm born and raised in this country. So, yeah. You know, 2.8, 2.9 grade point average, which is pretty bad. So coming out of this, I was – not only was I really scared because the reality of, oh, my God, this is really, really bad. But so that was just incredibly fearful. But also I had that feeling of, oh, this is not fair. Poor me. This is right. horrible. Why me? Why me?
Well, because mom and dad told you to, right?
Yeah. I mean,
that's the deal, yeah. right?
And that was my initial impression and my feelings and emotions that were going through there. And I had like this aha moment one day. Uh-huh. Where I was just like, you know what? I get a grip of myself, you know, mm-hmm. take it easy, take a deep breath, take a step back, and let's just look at what's going on here. And the way I processed it was, okay, this is not ideal. This is obviously not good. And at that point, we had like, this is 1994. We had over $10 million in debt. We had a business where the product was basically irrelevant in the marketplace.
The blouses, yeah.
You know, we had a real estate market that was crashing, so they started losing everything because there was too much debt on it. Interest rates back in the, you know, the early 90s were, I think we were paying like 12, 13%.
Yep.
You know, my parents are older and, you know, they're emotionally and mentally unstable with the turmoil that's going on. You have the family's bankruptcy that they dumped on us,
yep.
which dealing with that as well. So as I looked at that, I went, okay, it's not ideal. It's a bit difficult. But if I put some perspective on this, my parents came from the north to the south to this country with zero, absolutely nothing. And they've created something here that's pretty amazing. And if I take a further step back, you look at the Korean-American community in L.A. and in the United States, same story. And if you take even a further step back, you look at America and the United States as an entirety, this is the history of America. It's a bunch of people from all over the place that had nothing that came and in a very short period of time took this nothing and through will and hard work and, you know, perseverance and everything else created the most powerful country in the world in a very short period of time. So as I started realizing that perspective, I was like, okay, you know what? Boo-hoo for yourself.
you know, get to work, right?
This is not that crazy. It's big. But I think also what really helped me was I was also very ignorant and not, you know, maybe that sharp to understand exactly what the magnitude of it
was. Well, you didn't know what you didn't know, right?
Yeah, that's I didn't know. So I was like, hey, you know what? I just realized, had the self-realizing moment of gaining some perspective on this. If that's possible, maybe this is possible as well. But at the very least, my whole attitude has shifted from poor me and blah, blah, blah to, hey, you know what? We're going to lay down the hardest and big, strongest and craziest fight you've ever seen.
Right.
And if we lose, at least let's lose with honor and with, you know, just dignity to say we did everything we possibly could to do the right thing. And if we didn't, then at least it's a honorable, noble death. So yeah. That was an attitude that we took.
From the family business, you start your own company called Jane's Army.
That was my first run of premium denim.
Which doesn't go so well.
It, yeah. You know, it's,
tell me why. Because you're pretty clear on this in some of the interviews I read with you.
So after my family business, doing that and getting it back to healthy, we ended up paying all the debt back. And at that point, it was interesting because we were just dumping everything. Whatever we had that had value, we were just selling, because we were trying to get the debt load as low as possible, because I think we were paying like $50,000, $55,000 a month just on interest. And so we're dumping things, and I could see my parents the pain, mm-hmm. because there's stuff that they worked their whole lives for and that had real value and was probably just the beginning. And to put it in perspective, there was one apartment building that they owned in Koreatown, mm-hmm. And my best friend, who just got into real estate, ended up selling it for us, and it was a big deal. It was like a $6 million deal, but yeah. It was 144 units or something like that. And at that point, we thought, oh, okay, we did well. We're able to pay a chunk of the debt down with this. Today, that thing is worth, and I asked him a few months back, how much is this worth? He goes, you don't want to know. Yeah, I know. I want to know. And he goes, it's probably $35 million. And that's just one property. I think they realize and could appreciate it. So as we're dumping everything, you can see the pain. But at the same time, I'm saying, I don't know what else to do. We got to survive now. Yeah. As we're going through that process, finally got it all worked around, had an amazing experience through these hardships. And as we turned everything around, in 2000, for me, that's where I really loved and had a passion for apparel and fashion and so forth. But I realized that, I have a bigger story I want to tell. I want to share my experiences and share my perspective, because as tough and horrible as I think mine was. Yeah. I also believe that it's not unique to me. I think we all have similar stories, and I just, again, my whole goal is how can I share my perspective and what I did to get around this.
Which gets us to Jane's Army.
Which went to actually Drunken Monkey.
Well, which is a whole nother company.
Yeah, which is a streetwear company. Right. And then through that process, started Jane's Army, and that was my first run at premium denim. I had a creative guy who were working together. And the beginning was great. We blew up out of the scene because it was in 2000, so super early on the premium denim side. This thing takes off, but then we're making it in Thailand. The whole category is new. We ended up couldn't control quality, couldn't control deliveries. We ended up basically the product was not what we thought it was going to be.
Right.
We shipped it anyways, thinking, okay, maybe we have a shot,
which was a huge
mistake.
So you learned that lesson.
Yeah, real quick, because what ended up happening is we sold it into all the top stores, and we just took a flyer and said, maybe it'll work. I mean, not even deep down inside, it was pretty upfront. We knew it's probably not a good idea, but we did it anyways, took a shot, didn't work. I thought, this is too much, Sure. And but at that point, end up shutting the company down because I'm like, okay, this is too. We might as well restart because to go back to them and say, hey, we really did fix all the problems. I thought it was too much work.
So, what made you then after Jane's Army and the all right? So here's the word failure, mm-hmm. right? Of
yeah,
that
absolutely.
Company, right?
Absolutely.
Why did you want to get back into premium denim?
I found this passion in premium denim because one of key points in my life is really about challenging the norm, societal norms, tradition, the status quo. And I think a lot of that has to do with my history and the way I was put in boxes, and I didn't fit in any boxes.
Yeah.
And then pretty much marked off as a loser, deadbeat.
So this is going to come across tricky on the radio, but it's important now that people understand how we're sitting here in the studio, right? To look at you, you are not a guy who would appear to be a company CEO, right?
Yes.
I mean, you've got your very own sense of personal style, and it's distinct. It's not corporate in any way, right? You got the tats going, you got the earrings going, and somebody looks at you and they're not going to say, oh, yeah, he runs a X, million dollar a year, a premium denim company.
Yes. I'm not that guy, right? Yeah. I'm not the suit guy. Yeah. And again, that goes back into just the money part, the success part for me. The success has not much to do with the money part. And I understand the money part's important. It is a necessity and it's really important. But what I always believe is the money isn't what defines me. It is a product of doing something, hopefully really well, that's impactful, that affects lives. And I think if you can do that, because I believe in passion. I believe that one of the greatest things that we're missing in life is passion for life and finding. And I think you start finding passion through purpose. Like if you can find a purpose and a meaning in your life that's greater than money, then because I just don't believe the purpose of life is money. You know, it's a necessity, but by definition, money is a tool, right? It's a medium of exchange, which is a tool. Yeah. So part of what I was saying is I am very anti-status quo, anti-tradition, because I think in today's world, we've been led to believe that our whole purpose is to make as much money as we can.
Okay, but, right? I mean, I get all that, and I totally understand where you're coming from, but here you are selling blue jeans for $150 or $300 a pop.
Right.
Help me.
How to define it?
Yeah, so, help me make sense of that with your ethos.
Our product, there's a lot of quality, love, and passion that goes into it. So it's not something that we make for dirt cheap and sell it for, you know, $200. The fabric, the wash, and what I think a lot of people may not know or know is denim is something that's very different. And I'm sure everybody's going to say this about their product, but denim truly is. It's something that's very different than most apparel products.
How come?
It's very unstable. When you just start with the fabric alone, it is a very unstable fabric, and you can find fabric anywhere from like a dollar a yard to like $15,
$20 a yard. You mean the actual denim, the bolt itself, of denim fabric?
Yeah,
wow.
The fabric itself, just to start with that, you can find it anywhere from literally a dollar to $20+. And
is that like a yard or however you measure it?
By a yard, a yard meter. And so you start with that, and you know all of our denim is coming out of either Italy or Turkey, out of these premium mills that they produce top quality fabric. And so it starts with that. And that fabric, what happens is each roll is incredibly it's just unstable. So each roll could possibly have different characteristics from roll to roll, even in the same exact style, if you will.
So you have to have people opening the rolls, cutting them, matching
testing
all
them,
of that.
Wash, shrinkage, and so forth, every single roll to create consistency. On top of that, what we do with it is we don't just cut and sew and then here it is. There's wash processes, there's hand processes, there's literally people that are doing the work on this. So it takes a lot of labor. There's a lot of we call love that goes into this.
Sure.
In the pre-production piece of it, through the production piece of it, and then even after with, you know, packaging and trim and everything else that we put into it. So, you know, it's a common question that I get asked, especially when people see me and understand my perspective and the way I think about this. But it's something that, you know, we're fanatical about quality. It's been the foundation of everything that we build on. But at the same time, our bigger point in this is, you know, what we always say is the product that I'm selling is really our message, our core purpose and core values and our principles. That's what we're selling. And our consumer product, whether it's blue jeans or tops or whatever else it is, that consumer product that we're selling is really the tool that we use to connect with our customers.
Can I ask you a geopolitical question here for a minute? You do some assembly and processing work in Mexico, right?
We do a lot now.
So here we are in the Trump administration.
Yeah.
And the Mexican trade relationship is very much on the table. How much of a pain is that going to be for you?
It's going to be really interesting. I thought it'd be an interesting conversation today because it's just getting hotter and more heated as we come. So I don't know. You know, one of the things we started our career in the company, we were producing 100% in LA, and it was possible back in, you know, 2003 or so. Over time and more recent times, it's become almost impossible to produce in LA and still maintain reasonable pricing.
Yeah, I mean, you see that with like American Apparel and Nasty Gal and all that jazz, right?
It's it's just, you know, between minimum wage and healthcare and energy and so forth and so forth, it's getting to a point where to produce it here, the prices, when it finally hits retail, it would be like 30-40% higher.
Right. So now you're a guy. I mean, conceivably, the president of the United States could tweet tomorrow about Hudson Jeans and say, Hudson Jeans is not going to get its product into the United States without a 30% tariff.
Yeah.
Right?
That's possible. It's very possible. That would probably have a huge hit to premium denim in general. Not just for us.
Yeah, not just you, but
in general. Because what we're doing, we're ahead of it. Because I believe that as a premium denim category, watching this come through, we got ahead of it several years ago. So started looking at different options on where we could produce. So we've looked at globally, like Turkey, Italy, even Mexico. What's the cost and benefits of keeping it here? So we still do some here. You know, we're looking all over the place to see where we can have the best quality and still have the proper pricing. And with the newest wrinkle, I guess, we'll just have to relook at our production strategy. Hmm. And again, it's really new, but we were optimistic about the Mexico transition because, you know, it's I've been down to Mexico. The factories down there, they're impeccable. You know, you could literally eat off the floors of these factories where it's state-of-the-art facilities. There's incredible benefits for the employees. And, you know, we have a very strict rule of partnering up with people that we believe in, that we like, that share core values and so forth. So we're close with our factories as far as, you know, the ownership and so forth, because it's important for us that they understand what we believe in and how we do our business. So going down there, looking at their factories, there's just incredible factories. But now, again, we just have to relook at what's going to happen and what are the possible outcomes of whatever he's going to incorporate or implement.
Are you generally optimistic for your business?
I am. I mean, I you know, it's funny. It's a common question because in my career, I've turned around a failing family business. I've started several businesses. I've gone through, at this point, I think 4 sales transactions. And, you know, one of the common questions people ask is, what are you doing now? Are you retired? Are you surfing all day long? Like, what's your deal? And, you know, I tell people all the time, I wake up every day more excited than ever because I feel like my career is just getting started. Like, with everything that I've been through, with all of my experiences and so forth, and I had this very specific thing about experience where for most I think it's a bad thing, but from my experiences and how that's turned into knowledge and wisdom and having a whole different perspective of where I'm at and the growth, both professionally and, you know, personally, I feel like I'm literally just getting started. And I love Hudson. You know, I'm so passionate about it, for what we stand for, what we represent, and our whole mission here is, how do we change the world? You know, how can we change the world through our way of business, through our perspective, and what we're doing to make a positive impact? And, you know, we as a company have a strong belief in our core purpose. We have values that we're very strict by and we believe in, and we have an organization of incredibly passionate people as well. So I love going to work. You know, like, I'm one of those guys that even when I'm on vacation, I just enjoy working. And people are like, well, that's too bad. You know, you need to relax. I'm like, this is relaxing for me. I love what I do. Most of the times I'd say, I can't even believe I get paid to do this.
I say the same thing every day.
Yeah, right? Every day. It's like, and I think this is magic, right? When you are doing something and you do it no matter what and you get paid and, you know, financially it works out and it's really successful and so forth, I sit there and say, wow, this is unbelievable. So it's one of those things that I hope to share with other people, because even internally within our company, I tell people all the time, if you're not passionate about this place, if you don't love coming here, you got to go. And early on, people are like, whoa, that's horrible. I'm like, what do you mean that's horrible? And the comment I realized was like, it sounds like you don't care about us. And I would look at him and go, it's a complete opposite.
It's the other way around, man. Yeah.
I love you guys so much that I want you guys to find something that you're passionate about, because when you have that, it's magical. And you know what I'm talking about, right? So that's what I hope that more people can experience.
Peter Kim. The company is Hudson Jeans. Peter, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It was enjoyable.
All right, that's it for today. We've got another interview for you in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening to this Corner Office podcast. If you're already a subscriber, take a minute, leave us a comment or a review on iTunes. It does help people find us, seriously. And also, while you're at it, check out Make Me Smart, me and Molly Wood.